So the question for the afternoon is, how well do you fit into your jeans? And so we spent a little time. I'm going to build on some themes that John beautifully set the stage for this morning. And to explore, I want to explore with you, and some of this may be review, but always updating. How many of you are familiar with epigenetics? Several of you. So my intent in what I wish to share is to look at how the outside gets inside. How do the foods that we eat translate in a way that either takes our immune systems and jacks them up, revs them up, or brings them to a place of balance? How do the thoughts in our heads influence our DNA, our book of life, in a way that either translates a narrative that would serve us well, or perhaps creates a narrative that might create some significant challenges? And I think we really are in the midst of this knowledge explosion. It is said that the amount of research, the amount of knowledge over the last year equals that of the last 10. And it is said that by 2020, very soon, medical knowledge is going to double virtually every week. And with internet and with open access, there's just so much information out there, which is overwhelming and mind-boggling. And I can tell you there is no institution that will be able to translate this in real time in a way that will allow most people to leverage the news to use at the moment that they're hearing it. If you're in a medical school, you're in a pedagogy, and any of you who have been in academics know that it takes a long time to change anything. It can take me, and I'm an associate dean of a large medical school, it can take me 2 years to change a one-hour talk at the undergraduate medical school level. If you look at the research enterprise, well-intentioned though it may be, most of this work does not lend itself to randomized placebo-controlled trials. The methodology that has become the basis of best evidence is really not very good methodology to help someone determine whether gluten is a problem in their life, whether bisphenol A from plastics is a problem in their life, whether a particular microbiome pattern is of a particular problem for that person. So we have methodologies that to this day are considered gold standards that no longer fit the paradigm of self-care in a way that I think can inform the average person and give them a sense of how best to navigate moving forward. And then we have advisory boards and professional organizations, again, well-intentioned, beautiful, compassionate people, the American Heart Association, the American Diabetes Association, the American Cancer Association, the Academy of Dietetics and Nutrition, that these are not nimble institutions. They're comprised of people that harbor biases. They are comprised of financial streams that create conflicts of interest. And the best intentions, by the time they reach the individual, will more times than not reflect the best evidence, the best roadmap for how one thinks about moving forward. So part of what certainly John and I have fun doing, and we think very differently today, is we've been teaching for many years, and I think back on some programs we've taught and how different our message today is compared to what our message was then. I'm sure there are many things I'm going to share with you that will turn out not to be the most accurate way to think about what's going on and how to connect the dots. And so at the end of the day, we are left to be as wise as we can in the choices we make. And each will have a consequence. And so our encouragement is always to discern the information. If it doesn't make sense, at the end of the day, you might try something different than what you're currently doing. And often in a matter of just a few weeks, 2 to 4 weeks, you can then experience whether or not that change is influencing your unique biochemical and unique genetic identity. And that to me is the most important laboratory of life, what John and I would call the N equals one, your life, your beautiful, precious life, whether it's fat may not be as bad as we thought it is, whole wheat may be much more of a demon than we thought it was, whether sunlight is really what we need more than anything as opposed to what we're being told, I think it's just always good. And I know you're all here because you challenge conventional wisdom. No one would make a journey like this if they weren't intellectually very curious and very driven to search. And there's something very gratifying about being present with people who come with that mindset. The other kind of sobering aspect of this journey is how humbling it can be to, after perhaps many years, come to realize that red is really blue, or that black is really gray. Our perceptions, as it turns out, tend to guide us, and yet, as Einstein said, our perceptions tend to be more illusory than real. And I do an exercise with our medical residents. I do a lot of teaching of residents and medical students and in our community and with John all over. But an exercise I like to do, and if you could indulge me for one minute, if you're able, raise your right hand and point your finger up toward this beautiful ceiling, roof, and make a clockwise circle, nice clockwise circle. Keep your finger moving clockwise. Don't change anything, except lower your hand, gradually lower your hand to the level of your heart. And as you look at your hand finger, what direction is it moving in? Yeah. So what's going on with that? I've done this a million times, and I still have to slow it down to see it's clockwise. So here's an example. This is always fun at parties. Here's an example, albeit a simple one, of a set of conditions, when perceived a certain way, would lead to the conclusion that your finger is moving clockwise, and nobody could convince you otherwise of that conclusion. And without doing anything other than changing your perspective of the same sets of conditions, you could arrive at the exact opposite conclusion. And so for me, that's the perfect metaphor for life. An interesting journey it is. So I met John at a place called Kripalu. And I know some of you have had experiences at Kripalu. This is a center for yoga and meditation. It happens to be where I live, which is just amazing. And at the time, John and I were helping to develop what we called healthy living programs. It was this amazing opportunity to bring the best of the East to the best of the West and create this integrated model of holistic care. And about 12 years ago, I'll never forget this, I was asked by the CEO at the time of Kripalu, "Mark, who is the most influential yogi in your life?" And I know some of you don't know who this guy is, but this is Yogi Berra. He's an iconic American that played for the New York Yankees, died a few years ago at the tender age of 95. And the great Yogi once said, "The future ain't what it used to be. The future ain't what it used to be." And when I look at all the things today that I would have never thought possible, I can't help but think 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, what are we going to look back on 2017 and 2018 and say, "Wow, what were we thinking?" Because surely those things exist today, as they will always exist. And this is why I think self-stewardship is so important. As our lives change, as our environment changes, nothing is static. The great yogi understood that. And another interesting fellow, Will Rogers. This was an American, 19th century American author, humorist, once said, "It's not what we don't know that gets us into trouble. It's what we know that ain't so." And one of the things that we know that ain't so is that there's not much I can do about my DNA. This continues today to be pretty much mainstream thinking. Hardly a day goes by when I'm not seeing a client, and the client is telling me, "Dr. Pettis, I saw my primary care doctor this week. I saw my endocrinologist. I have type 2 diabetes. It runs in my family. They told me it's genetic. I inherited this hand of cards, and there's very little I can do about it. I can take medications. I can eat less and do more. And there are a whole host of medications that I can take." Most of the people that I see are totally convinced that whatever it is they are confronting is locked into their DNA, and they have very little control over it. And if your perceptual landscape is you have something over which you have no control, what motivation would there be to try to influence or transform that which you are experiencing? Which is not to say that genetics aren't important. There are some things that are driven by genetics and are dominant and will predictably be passed from one generation to another, but they tend to be a very small percentage of that which most of us confront in our lives. So we'll look at challenging this historical paradigm. And one of the things I love about epigenetics, and epigenetics is really the capacity for our environment to change the expression of our DNA, to take the cards that you've been dealt and to place new cards into that hand, to give you a chance to throw three cards in and get three from the deck. And maybe that lousy hand becomes three of a kind, or becomes two pairs, or becomes a royal flush. Who knows? But this is a very different proposition with respect to how humans function in relationship to the environments that they are in. And the other beautiful aspect of this, even though the research is very limited, is you can take consciousness, energy, as Carla so beautifully facilitated in our opening evening, and Simone this morning. The energy of the universe continues to evolve and very much influences us at the level of our DNA. Our DNA becomes an instrument. It's not the source of the composition. It is an instrument whereby the universe and all that it encompasses works through that instrument. And there's something very hopeful about that message. And so this is an attempt to summarize what I think this new paradigm that is emerging looks like. And it all starts, most importantly, with our environment. And by environment, I'm referring to how we eat, how we move, how we sleep, how we interpret and respond to stress in our lives. As Simone so beautifully illustrated earlier today, stress happens. Stress will continue to happen. Our power is in our capacity to interpret and respond in an infinite number of ways. The environmental toxins in our environment, how socially connected we are, how much love we cultivate in our work, in our play, loving relationships, every aspect of our environment is now known to have some impact on our DNA. Can take something that you've inherited and turn it off, or keep the switch in the on position. And the current trajectory of this relationship would suggest that the more compatible one's environment is with one's genetic legacy, and we're going to look at this legacy in a moment, the more likely one is to produce a composition that will be much more beautiful and harmonious than the composition we might currently be experiencing in our lives. Very dynamic relationship. And then we have this new player. These alone are game changers. There isn't a biology book on planet Earth that accurately reflects what current research today is telling us about not just how our environment influences our book of life, but how our environment influences this very complex microbiologic ecosystem on our skin, in our mouths, in our nasal passage, mostly in our colon. We're going to spend a lot of time this week looking at the gut. The gut is a fault line for many chronic complex diseases. And we know that every aspect of environment that has been studied, from positive thoughts versus negative thoughts, loving relationships versus trauma and adverse childhood events, from whole unprocessed foods versus processed foods, will impact the microbiome. And the organisms in your microbiome will influence your gene expression patterns. It's this incredible triad of complex interrelationship, malleable, plastic. This can change relatively quickly in response to changes here. Sorry, you look down. Changes here can affect this quickly. Changes in food will affect your microbiome. And in the same way, changes in one's microbiome will influence one's gene expression patterns. Very dynamic, all with some interplay with one another, and malleable. And so our lives, from a somewhat materialistic perspective, seem to emerge at this interesting intersection. And then none of this, and this I think is the future of healthcare and maybe the future of everything that we do on our planet, is this, at least from a scientific perspective, elusive and abstract consciousness, spirit, meaning, however that is defined for that individual. When you look at quantum physics, and what's interesting to me about quantum physics, and I'm hardly expert at it, I'm kind of an amateur, I just love thinking about it. We've known for 100 years that which we see, that which we see and touch and smell, the material world that we live in, represents about 4 to 5% of our reality. It is a small and relatively insignificant aspect of our reality. 95% of our reality is in the form, as Nikola Tesla would have said, or as Einstein would have said, energy, vibration, electromagnetic fields, light. As we talked about light this morning, light is simply a form of electromagnetic energy that we appreciate as color. So most of who we are is space. And at an energetic level, and this is where I think the cosmos and humans as material manifestations of energy makes this story so much more fascinating. And while we spend so much of our time in our modern medical enterprise focusing on the tangible, this is where the magic and the mystery resides. And our experience this morning was a profound way of experiencing how this can impact our lives. So this is your book of life. And it's really nothing to look at. We have 23 pairs of chromosomes. One pair from mom, one pair from dad. And each of our cells picks up the pairs. And this is our, some might say this is sort of our blueprint. This is sort of the hardware that is necessary to run the operating machinery. And think about the fact that modern humans, modern Homo sapiens, hit the scene about 200,000 years ago, maybe a little bit longer, which means, at least from an evolutionary biologic perspective, each of us here had several thousand generations of modern humans that preceded us. And they did. They lived at some point in time, and they lived long enough to reproduce, to have kids that lived long enough to reproduce, had kids that lived long enough to reproduce generation after generation after generation, you know, 6,997 generations later, grandmother, grandfather, mother, father, you. So here we are at La Montaña Azul, December 4th, 2017, the incarnate inhabitants of a book of life that has been fine-tuned over thousands of generations. Your book of life is much older than your chronologic age, and it has been fine-tuned in an attempt to adapt to the environments that preceded us in a way that would assure the likelihood that each of those generations would live long enough to reproduce. It's a remarkable success story. So we have a book of life that really today would not look very different than it did for our ancestors that roamed the African savannah. Think about that. Your book of life, and maybe it's changed a little bit, but from a fundamental perspective, it has not changed much over the last several thousands of years. But what has changed radically and in an accelerated way is the environment within which we live. And while the remarkable success story of this evolutionary journey is truly noteworthy, it is not so effective that it can quickly and effectively adapt to the changes we've seen in our food supply over the last couple generations, to the changes that we have seen in the sheer number of environmental toxins in our environment, from the foods that we eat, to plasticizers, to pesticides and chemicals, to cosmetics. These are new to nature molecules that Book of Life, as it has been previously written and authored, has very little familiarity with. I grew up eating a lot of processed foods. My mother was very sick growing up. On most days, she could not prepare a meal for my sister and I. My father was a blue-collar guy who never missed a day of work in 40 years. When I ate a bowl of sugar smacks or sugar pops or frosted flakes or Pop-Tarts, there was nothing about that food to me that seemed foreign or unusual. It was really tasty. You know, it was gave me a lot of pleasure. But in retrospect, my book of life was, you know, these were new to nature molecules. They've been around maybe for, you know, a generation, a little bit more than that. So that's the challenge. We've got a book of life that is not well designed for the modern environment that we live in. And we're resilient enough that we can take a hit, or maybe take many hits, and bounce back. We're resilient, tremendously resilient organisms. And we're living longer because of that resilience, but we're not living well. We talked about average life expectancy in 1900 being 48, and we've added significantly to that. But most people have tremendous burden of chronic complex disease. It's not a quality of life that most people would want. And so common is that trajectory that we assume these to be normal consequences of the aging process. And much like I have people tell me every day that this is genetic because it runs in their family, what runs in their family are the sociocultural and environmental conditions that created those diseases. It's not something immutable, fixed or locked into their DNA. So the Genome Project, this is Craig Venter. This is a really interesting read if anyone is interested in the story of the Human Genome Project. I was a little over, I want to say around 2000, early 21st century. Venter was the first to elucidate his DNA, his book of life. What's also interesting about Craig Venter is he could have never done the pioneering work he did in any academic institution. There were too many restrictions. Too many rules, too many regulations, too many parochial ways of thinking about what's right. So he had to basically raise the capital to create his own lab in La Jolla, California, to do remarkable, groundbreaking work. And there were some surprises that came from this, because the mindset of the medical establishment was everything is genetic. So once we figure out what the human genome is all about, we're going to find a diabetes gene, we're going to find an Alzheimer's gene, we're going to find a heart disease gene, we'll find various cancer genes, and then we're going to be able to fix everything. And none of that has played out as anticipated, not even close. One thing we found out is that humans have 23,000 genes, and your genes code for proteins that run your hardware. The Pinot Noir grape has about 30, 35,000 genes. There's absolutely no correlation whatsoever between the number of genes you have and how sophisticated you are as an organism. That surprised scientists. What does set us apart from other species is our epigenome. Virtually 97% of our DNA is the regulatory portion that turns things on and off. We have more of that than other species. What they did find was there really weren't many disease genes. There are a few, Huntington's chorea, polycystic kidney disease. There are strong genetic determinants for age-related macular degeneration. But as I will point out later this week with John, I still think a lot of that is driven on an environmental level for many. What we have instead are these tiny little shifts in our book of life, replacing one letter in the narrative with another letter, replacing an A with an E, or an I with a U. And the average human has millions of these little typos, if you will, in their book of life. And what we're starting to realize, and I think with big data computing capacity, as we get into quantum computing, we're going to start to determine, this is like looking up at the night sky and trying to see constellations that currently are very hard to see. And I think it's probably over the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to find that it's not a disease gene that puts us at risk. It's the constellation of millions of these little, tiny little variables. And based on those constellations, the environment that we are living in will either be compatible with this or will not be compatible. And there'll be things that we can do by way of how we eat and how we move and how we sleep and how we interpret and respond to stress and how effectively we navigate the minefields of conflict and whether or not we're likely to forgive in response to a prior hurt or transgression and the love we cultivate in our work and play. All of these things we're going to be able to modulate in a way that will create better alignment with our unique constellations. So this story, instead of revealing disease genes over which we could influence, has revealed patterns that ultimately create a much more complex relationship. And I think in this perennial debate of nature versus nurture, it's really nature via nurture. This is really what influences how this manifests. And that is a very different proposition than this is in your family, too bad, you can take this, 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 and this. And there may be some value in taking this, this, and this, but it certainly doesn't get to the roots of these relationships. And what we're finding from this epigenetic, how the outside gets inside, is that virtually everything that has been studied, from how entrained we are with circadian rhythms. We talked a little bit about that this morning. We live in environments today that are artificially lit. We're in light for much longer periods of time than our ancestors. And the quality of light that we're in has really been downgraded. So not only do we get less good quality light, we get more bad quality light. It's a really bad combination. And as it turns out, our DNA is very sensitive to this diurnal rhythm, which is what you would expect from a book of life that's been written over thousands of generations that were in close and intimate relationship with day-night cycles. And there are no shortage of toxins in our environment, drugs of abuse. If you're a lower socioeconomic status, a lot of the work that I do is with the underserved. You have a much greater risk of dying at a younger age. You have a much greater risk of not only dying at a younger age, but dying with lots of health issues. And these are transgenerational. Families that are struggling with maybe abuse, domestic abuse, addiction, these are very hard cycles to break. I call these the diseases of despair, the social determinants. A lot of my work in population health is creating systems which don't currently exist that can combine clinical infrastructure with community-based infrastructure, health coaches, community health workers, faith communities, schools, workplaces that can begin to meet people where they're at in an effort to give them some tools and resources to help them navigate in a more effective way. And the list goes on, and I'll show you some examples of the research in terms of how all of these things influence genetic, epigenetic modulation, all of which ultimately translates into your life story. So interestingly, this book of life in one environment will produce a different individual than same book of life in another environment. Two different phenotypes. Same book of life, different environments, totally different beings emerge from that relationship. And this, unfortunately, has become the environment for so many people over the last generation or two. And is it a coincidence that we're seeing an explosion of chronic complex diseases across the board? Certainly in America, you're seeing it now in China. Diabetes is now epidemic in China. It didn't exist a generation ago. In India, off the charts. It is inevitable that when you take a Homo sapien book of life, written as it has been written, and you immerse it into an environment like this, the output is one that will create accelerated aging and a very high burden of chronic complex disease. And we're beginning to understand that aging has an epigenetic signature. The on and off switches in our DNA will either accelerate aging. One way it would do that would be by promoting inflammation, you know, revving up your immune system more than it was intended to rev up, taking your mitochondria, which John was talking a little bit about, and breaking them down, taking your gut and the flora in your gut and obliterating them. We're starting to see fingerprints that are more predictive of how this person will appear later in life. And while we can't prevent aging, the issue for me isn't so much living longer, it's living better. We don't need research to help us live to be 150. We need research to help us get to 80 in good health. And so this is just another example of this, these interesting relationships. And if you look at maternal nutrition, right, prenatal nutrition, over or under nutrition, some of which we touched on, vitamin D status. I'm going to talk in a moment about these methyl donors. Methyl is basically the on and off switch. Methylation is a simple molecule that can take a gene and turn it on or turn it off. Who would have thought? The quality of fat intake, and in this instance, you know, these polyunsaturated fats, most of which today are processed, these omega-6 vegetable oils. These are new-to-nature molecules. Canola oil is a new-to-nature molecule that no generation before perhaps the last has ever been exposed to, as opposed to omega-3s, for example. If you look at the microbiome of the mother, and again, we're just beginning to learn about this, whether the child is born by C-section, if a child is born C-section, and you look at the flora of that child, it will look like skin bacteria. If you look at a child who was born vaginally, as nature intended, the microbiome will be a much more diverse representation of mother's vaginal flora. Diversity is good in any ecosystem. And in America, 1 out of 3 births is cesarean section. And there are some instances where that's necessary, perhaps, to save mom and save child. But there's a problem when you have a culture doing 2 to 3 times as many of these as other cultures, many of whom have much longer life expectancy than us, and much better child and infant mortality than us, us meaning the United States. And then look at whether that child gets breast milk or is fed formula. Big difference in terms of how that impacts the microbiome and the epigenome of that child. So you begin to see how conditions far in advance of conception will set the epigenetic narrative that will ultimately become the narrative of the child that is born from that conception. And modifiable factors, like whether a child is born vaginally or not. What a lot of hospitals now for C-section kids are taking Q-tip swabs of mother's vaginal flora, and they're inoculating that child, which is a really good thing to do. It's still not standard of practice. So you start going upstream, and you realize that whether a child has ADD or ADDHD or is on the autism spectrum or has asthma, or is obese, will probably have determinants that far exceeded even conception of that child. That's what epigenetics is all about. If you had a great-grandparent that smoked at the age of 15 in 1900, that could be affecting your health here today in 2017. It's kind of a mind-bender. Yes? Please. Yes. I think everything we see today can predominantly, of course, these are all complicated questions with complicated answers, but in simplicity, I would say the majority have come by virtue of changes in our environment. So if you look at allergies, life-threatening peanut allergies have tripled in the last 20 years. That's not a genetic mutation. There isn't a peanut allergy disease gene. However, there may be epigenetic on and off switch patterns that that child was born with, combined with alterations in their microbiome, combined with the types of foods that that child was fed, that led to leaky gut, which led to a hypervigilant immune system, which would take an otherwise innocuous legume for that individual and create a life-threatening immunologic response. And when you look at all of those things, the epigenetic on-off switches, the microbiome, the quality of the foods, they're all modifiable. And I think the same can be said for most other chronic health issues in childhood and in adulthood. We have a lot more to learn about how these relationships work, but I think some of these mechanisms are at least beginning to point to the importance of alignment with one's environment, with what might be some unique predisposition. Yes, Marianne.
I see so many factors going the wrong direction. Where do you get hope? Do you think the grassroots level, the internet, how do you think this is going to change?
Yeah, well, I'd appreciate others' responses to that question as well, but I can tell you, we're not in a very good place right now. Where I have hope is in, A, the fact that many of the things that we accept as inevitable outcomes are not inevitable at all. That alone gives me hope. I think when I look at the knowledge revolution and the fact that most people do have access to internet information, that more people, I think, are interested. You know, Walmart is selling organic produce now. And I see prices coming down for foods that historically have been much more pricey because demand wasn't as great, and there weren't as many people, you know, producing those things. And I think as a species, we're beginning to become sick and tired with the quality of life that many of us are experiencing and are searching to try to find answers to that. But part of the challenge there is that, and we'll look at the neuroscience, as Homo sapiens, as primates, our tendency, 90% of Americans, for example, think they're in good health. That's Kaiser data, West Coast, a lot of people. 90% think their health, they would rate it good to excellent, 90%. And about 90% of Americans think that the greatest determinant of their health and longevity is the quality of healthcare, quality of the hospitals in their communities, the quality of the doctors in their communities. And there's very good evidence from most public health institutions, Robert Wood Johnson, University of Wisconsin, about 20% of how long we live and how well we live is influenced by hospitals and doctors. Most of it is influenced by the social determinants of health, education, loving relationships, close connected communities, all of which have socioeconomics, all of which have influence on our behaviors, how we choose. And so socioeconomics and lifestyle behaviors probably account for about 80% of chronic complex disease. So people perceive that the answers are out there. They don't perceive, you know, that the answers are in here. And we're looking in the wrong places for the answers that we're desperately seeking. I'm hopeful because, you know, I'm less likely to go into fight flight if I'm hopeful. It's just a more strategic, but I don't know, Marianne. I think we are in a really difficult place right now, and it's probably going to get worse before it gets better. John, do you want to comment on that or others?
I don't know how much hope I have for the near future.
Yeah.
I think at least in the United States, the healthcare system is going to implode. I mean, you know, Mark knows these numbers better than I do, but the number of diabetics, the number of people who, as Mark said, think that they're in good health but have things like non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, it's unbelievable. And I think that things, as Mark just said, are going to have to get much worse. But the good things that will come out of that, well, there will be a revolution. I think there'll be a revolution with the way people look at their lives, the way they look at their food, the way they look at relationships. So, you know, I think that's part of the cyclical nature of things, is that sometimes systems, ecosystems, you know, for every species over the course of, as far as we've looked back in biology, there are crashes in systems for one reason or another. And I think that in terms of the human health system as a model, I think it is going to get worse before it gets better, but I think that then there'll be this great awakening. And so that's what I'm hopeful for, is that it isn't, it isn't as pandemic as it appears it's going to be, and that it's just terrible to see so many people, as Mark said, that are underserved, that don't have access to the choices that so many people, let's say in the United States, do have. But yeah, I don't see anything, unfortunately, turning this battleship around in the near future. I think it's going to be a slow process, but I think there's this grassroots. I think someone said grassroots. There's an awakening. There's no shortages of documentaries on things like Netflix that try to highlight all the discords that exist between the way we were meant to live and the way we live now. And I think it's going to take a radical change in the way people look at their lives. I think people need to unplug. I think that's going to be a major part of the change. I think especially our children, and for their health, are going to have to get all the handheld devices out of their hands for a while. I think people are spending too much time in virtual reality instead of in reality.